Get to Andrews by 0630, Cap said. And ask for Dick Folsom. He's Major Puckridge's aide.
All right, Rainbird said. He had no intention of being anywhere near Andrews Air Force Base tomorrow.
Goodbye, Cap.
He hung up, then sat on the bed. He pulled on his old desert boots and started planning.
18. Hello, computer. Query status, John Rainbird, 14222. Andrews AFB, DC to San Diego, California. Final destination, Q9. Hello, Cap. Status, John Rainbird, 14222. Andrews, D.C. to San Diego, California. Final destination. Leaves Andrews AFB, 0700 hours EST. Status OK. Break.
Computers are children, Rainbird thought, reading this message. He had simply punched in Cap's new code, which Cap would have been stunned to know he had. And as far as the computer was concerned, he was Cap. He began to whistle tunelessly. It was just after sunset, and the shop moved somnolently along the channels of routine.
File top secret. Code, please. Code 19180.
Code 19180, the computer returned. Ready to file top secret. Rainbird hesitated only briefly and then tapped File.
John Rainbird, 14222. Andrews, D.C. to San Diego, California. Final destination. Cancel. 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 F9. 19180.
Filed. Then, using the codebook, Rainbird told the computer whom to inform of the cancellation. Victor Puckridge and his aide, Richard Folsom. These new instructions would be in the midnight telex to Andrews, and the plane on which he was to hitch a ride would simply take off without him. No one would know a thing, including Cap.
600, goodbye, computer, 600.
604, goodbye, Cap, 604. Rainbird pushed back from the keyboard. It would be perfectly possible to put a stop to the whole thing tonight, of course, but that would not be conclusive. The computer would back him up to a certain degree, but computer probabilities do not butter any bread. Better to stop them after the thing had begun, with everything hanging out. More amusing, too. The whole thing was amusing. While they had been watching the girl, the man had regained his ability, or had successfully hidden it from them all along. He was likely ditching his medication. Now he was running Cap as well, which meant that he was only one step away from running the organization that had taken him prisoner in the first place. It was really quite funny. Rainbird had learned that end games often were. He didn't know exactly what McGee had planned, but he could guess. They would go to Andrews all right, only Charlie would be with them. Cap could get her off the shop grounds without much trouble. Cap and probably no one else on Earth. They would go to Andrews, but not to Hawaii. It might be that Andy had planned for them to disappear into Washington, D.C., or maybe they would get off the plane at Durban and Cap would be programmed to ask for a staff car. In that case, it would be Chi-Town they would disappear into, only to reappear in screaming Chicago Tribune headlines a few days later. He had played briefly with the idea of not standing in their way at all. That would be amusing, too. He guessed that Cap would end up in a mental institution, raving about golf clubs and snakes in the grass, or dead by his own hand. As for the shop, might as well imagine what would happen to an anthill with a quart jar of nitroglycerin planted beneath it. Rainbird guessed that no more than 5 months after the press got its first whiff of the strange ordeal of the Andrew McGee family, the shop would cease to exist. He felt no fealty to the shop and never had. He was his own man, crippled soldier of fortune, copper-skinned angel of death, and the status quo here didn't mean bull rag in a pasture to him. It was not the shop that owned his loyalty at this point. It was Charlie. The two of them had an appointment. He was going to look into her eyes, and she was going to look into his, and it might well be that they would step out together, in flames. The fact that he might be saving the world from some almost unimaginable Armageddon by killing her had not played a part in his calculations either. He owed the world no more fealty than he did the shop. It was the world as much as the shop that had cast him rootless from a closed desert society that might have been his only salvation, or, lacking that, have turned him into a harmless, sterno-guzzling Injun Joe pumping gas at a 76 station, or selling fake Kachina dolls at a shitty little roadside stand somewhere along the highway between Flagstaff and Phoenix. But Charlie... They had been locked in a long waltz of death since that endless night of darkness during the power blackout. What he had only suspected that early morning in Washington, when he had done wandless, had developed into an irrefutable certainty. The girl was his. But it would be an act of love, not of destruction, because the converse was almost certainly true as well. It was acceptable. In many ways, he wanted to die, and to die at her hands, in her flames, would be an act of contrition, and possibly of absolution. Once she and her father were together again, she would become a loaded gun. No, a loaded flamethrower. He would watch her, and he would let the two of them get together. What would happen then? Who knew? And wouldn't knowing spoil the fun? 19. That night, Rainbird went to Washington and found a hungry lawyer who worked late hours. To this lawyer, he gave $300 in small bills. And in the lawyer's office, John Rainbird neatened his few affairs in order to be ready for the next day. Firestarter. 1. At 6 o'clock on Wednesday morning, Charlie McGee got up, took off her nightgown, and stepped into the shower. She washed her body and her hair, then turned the water to cold and stood shivering under the spray for a minute more. She toweled dry and then dressed carefully. Cotton underpants, silk slip, dark blue knee socks, her denim jumper. She finished by putting on her scuffed and comfortable loafers. She hadn't thought she would be able to sleep at all last night. She had gone to bed full of fear and nervous excitement. But she had slept, and dreamed incessantly not of Necromancer and the run through the woods, but of her mother. That was peculiar, because she didn't think of her mother as often as she used to. At times her face seemed misty and distant in her memory, like a faded photograph. But in her dreams of last night, her mother's face, her laughing eyes, her warm, generous mouth, had been so clear that Charlie might last have seen her just the day before. Now, dressed and ready for the day, some of the unnatural lines of strain had gone out of her face, and she seemed calm. On the wall beside the door leading into the kitchenette, there was a call button and a speaker grill set into a brushed chrome plate just below the light switch. She pressed the button now. "Yes, Charlie?" She knew the owner of the voice only as Mike. At 7 o'clock, about half an hour from now, Mike went off, and Lewis came on. "I want to go out to the stables this afternoon," she said, "and see Necromancer. Will you tell someone?"
"I'll leave a note for Dr. Hockstetter, Charlie."
"Thank you." She paused just for a moment. You got to know their voices. Mike, Lewis, Gary. You got pictures of how they must look in your mind, the way you got pictures of how the DJs you heard on the radio must look. You got to like them. She suddenly realized that she would almost certainly never talk to Mike again.
"Was there something else, Charlie?"
"No, Mike. Have a good day."
"Why, thank you, Charlie."
Mike sounded both surprised and pleased.
"You too."
She turned on the TV and tuned to a cartoon show that came on every morning over the cable. Popeye was inhaling spinach through his pipe and getting ready to beat the sauce out of Bluto. 1 o'clock seemed an age away. What if Dr. Hockstetter said she couldn't go out? On the TV screen, they were showing a cutaway view of Popeye's muscles. There were about 16 turbine engines in each one.
"He better not say that. He better not. Because I'm going. One way or the other, I'm going."
2. Andy's rest hadn't been as easy or as healing as his daughter's. He had tossed and turned, sometimes dozing, then starting out of the doze just as it began to deepen because the terrible leading edge of some nightmare touched his mind. The only one he could remember was Charlie staggering down the aisle between the stalls in the stable, her head gone and red-blue flames spouting from her neck instead of blood. He'd meant to stay in bed until 7 o'clock, but when the digital face of the clock beside the bed got to 6:15, he could wait no longer. He swung out and headed for the shower. Last night, at just past 9, Pinchot's former assistant, Dr. Nutter, had come in with Andy's walking papers. Nutter, a tall, balding man in his late 50s, was bumbling and avuncular. "Sorry to be losing you. Hope you enjoy your stay in Hawaii. Wish I was going with you. Ha ha. Please sign this." The paper Nutter wanted him to sign was a list of his few personal effects, including his key ring, Andy noticed with a nostalgic pang. He would be expected to inventory them once in Hawaii and initial another sheet that said that they had indeed been returned. They wanted him to sign a paper concerning his personal effects after they had murdered his wife, chased him and Charlie across half the country, and then kidnapped and held them prisoner. Andy found that darkly hilarious and Kafkaesque. "I sure wouldn't want to lose any of those keys," he thought, scrawling his signature. "I might need one of them to open a bottle of soda with some time, right, fellas?" There was also a carbon of the Wednesday schedule, neatly initialed by Cap at the bottom of the page. They would be leaving at 12:30, Cap picking Andy up at his quarters. He and Cap would proceed toward the eastern checkpoint, passing parking area C, where they would pick up an escort of 2 cars. They would then drive to Andrews and board the plane at approximately 1,500 hours. There would be 1 stop for refueling, at Durban Air Force Base, near Chicago. "All right," Andy thought. "Okay." He dressed and began to move about the apartment, packing his clothes, shaving tackle, shoes, bedroom slippers. They had provided him with 2 Samsonite suitcases. He remembered to do it all slowly, moving with the careful concentration of a drugged man. After he found out about Rainbird from Cap, his first thought had been a hope that he would meet him. It would be such a great pleasure to push the man who had shot Charlie with a tranquilizer dart and later betrayed her in even more terrible fashion, to put his gun to his temple and pull the trigger. But he no longer wanted to meet Rainbird. He wanted no surprises of any kind. The numb spots on his face had shrunk to pinpricks, but they were still there. A reminder that if he had to overuse the push, he would very likely kill himself. He only wanted things to go off smoothly. His few things were packed all too soon, leaving him with nothing to do but sit and wait. The thought that he would be seeing his daughter again soon was like a small coal of warmth in his brain. To him, too, 1 o'clock seemed an age away. 3. Rainbird didn't sleep at all that night. He arrived back from Washington around 5:30 a.m., garaged his Cadillac, and sat at his kitchen table drinking cup after cup of coffee. He was waiting for a call from Andrews, and until that call came, he would not rest easy. It was still theoretically possible for Cap to have found out what he had done with the computer. McGee had messed up Cap Hollister pretty well, but it still did not pay to underestimate. Around 6:45, the telephone rang. Rainbird set his coffee cup down, rose, went into the living room, and answered it. "Rainbird here?" "Rainbird, this is Dick Folsom at Andrews, Major Puckridge's aide."
"You woke me up, man," Rainbird said. "I hope you catch crabs as big as orange crates. That's an old Indian curse."
"You've been scrubbed," Folsom said. "I guess you knew."
"Yes. Cap called me himself last night."
"I'm sorry," Folsom said. "It's standard operating procedure, that's all."
"Well, you operated in standard fashion. Can I go back to sleep now?"
"Yeah. I envy you."
Rainbird uttered the obligatory chuckle and hung up. He went back into the kitchen, picked up his coffee cup, went to the window, looked out, saw nothing. Floating dreamily through his mind was the prayer for the dead. 4. Cap did not arrive in his office that morning until almost 10:30, an hour and a half later than usual. He had searched his small Vega from stem to stern before leaving the house. He'd become sure, during the night, that the car was infested with snakes. The search had taken him 20 minutes. The need to make sure there were no rattlers or copperheads, or something even more sinister and exotic, nesting in the darkness of the trunk, dozing on the fugitive warmth of the engine block, curled up in the glove compartment. He had pushed the glove compartment button with a broom handle, not wanting to be too close in case some hissing horror should leap out at him.
and when the map of Virginia tumbled out of the square hole in the dash, he had nearly screamed. Then, halfway to the shop, he had passed the Greenway golf course and had pulled over onto the shoulder to watch with a dreamy sort of concentration as the golfers played through the eighth and ninth. Every time one of them sliced into the rough, he was barely able to restrain a compulsion to step out of the car and yell for them to beware of snakes in the tall grass. At last, the blare of a ten-wheeler's air horn, he had parked with his left-hand wheel still on the pavement, had startled him out of his daze, and he drove on. His secretary greeted him with a pile of overnight telex cables, which Cap simply took without bothering to shuffle through them to see if there was anything hot enough to demand immediate attention. The girl at the desk was going over a number of requests and messages when she suddenly looked up at Cap curiously. Cap was paying no attention to her at all. He was gazing at the wide drawer near the top of her desk with a bemused expression on his face. "Pardon me," she said. She was still very much aware of being the new girl, even after all these months, of having replaced someone Cap had been close to, and perhaps had been sleeping with, she had sometimes speculated. "Hmm?" He looked around at her at last, but the blankness did not leave his eyes. It was somehow shocking, like looking at the shuttered windows of a house reputed to be haunted. She hesitated, then plunged. "Cap, do you feel all right? You look, well, a little white." "I feel fine," he said, and for a moment he was his old self, dispelling some of her doubts. His shoulders squared, his head came up, and the blankness left his eyes. "Anybody who's going to Hawaii ought to feel fine, right?" "Hawaii?" Gloria said doubtfully. It was news to her. "Never mind these now," Cap said, taking the message forms and interdepartmental memos and stuffing them all together with the telex cables. "I'll look at them later. Anything happening with either of the McGees?" "One item," she said. "I was just getting to it. Mike Kelleher says she asked to go out to the stable this afternoon and see a horse."
"Yes, that's fine," Cap said.
"And she buzzed back a little later to say she'd like to go out at 1:45.
"Fine, fine.
Will Mr. Rainbird be taking her out?"
"Rainbird's on his way to San Diego," Cap said with unmistakable satisfaction. "I'll send a man to take her over."
"All right. Will you want to see the..." She trailed off. Cap's eyes had wandered away from her, and he appeared to be staring at the wide drawer again. It was partway open. It always was, per regulations. There was a gun in there. Gloria was a crack shot, just as Rachel before her had been. "Cap, are you sure there's nothing wrong?"
"Ought to keep that shut," Cap said. "They like dark places. They like to crawl in and hide."
"They?" she asked cautiously.
"Snakes," Cap said, and marched into his office.
5. He sat behind his desk, the cables and messages in an untidy litter before him. They were forgotten. Everything was forgotten now except snakes, golf clubs, and what he was going to do at 1:45. He would go down and see Andy McGee. He felt strongly that Andy would tell him what to do next. He felt strongly that Andy would make everything all right. Beyond 1:45 this afternoon, everything in his life was a great funneling darkness. He didn't mind. It was sort of a relief.
6. At 9:45, John Rainbird slipped into the small monitoring room near Charlie's quarters. Louis Tranter, a hugely fat man whose buttocks nearly overflowed the chair he sat in, was watching the monitors. The digital thermometer read a steady 68 degrees. He looked over his shoulder when the door opened, and his face tightened at the sight of Rainbird.
"I heard you were leaving town," he said.
"Scrubbed," Rainbird said. "And you never saw me this morning at all, Louis."
Louis looked at him doubtfully.
"You never saw me," Rainbird repeated. "After 5 this afternoon, I don't give a shit, but until then, you never saw me. And if I hear you did, I'm going to come after you and cut me some blubber. Can you dig it?"
Louis Tranter paled noticeably. The Hostess Twinkie he had been eating dropped from his hand onto the slanted steel panel that housed the TV monitors and microphone pickup controls. It rolled down the slant and tumbled to the floor unheeded, leaving a trail of crumbs behind.
Suddenly he wasn't a bit hungry. He had heard this guy was crazy, and now he was seeing that what he had heard was certainly true.
"I can dig it," he said,
whispering in the face of that weird grin and glittering one-eyed stare.
"Good,"
Rainbird said and advanced toward him. Lewis shrank away from him, but Rainbird ignored him altogether for the moment and peered into one of the monitors. There was Charlie, looking pretty as a picture in her blue jumper. With a lover's eye, Rainbird noted that she had not braided her hair today. It lay loose and fine and lovely over her neck and shoulders. She wasn't doing anything but sitting on the sofa. No book, no TV. She looked like a woman waiting for a bus.
"Charlie," he thought admiringly, "I love you. I really do."
"What's she got going for today?" Rainbird asked.
"Nothing much," Lewis said eagerly. He was, in fact, nearly babbling. "Just going out at 1:15 to curry that horse she rides. We're getting another test out of her tomorrow."
"Tomorrow, huh?"
"Yep."
Lewis didn't give a tin shit about the tests, one way or the other, but he thought it would please Rainbird, and maybe Rainbird would leave. He seemed to be pleased. His grin reappeared.
"She's going out to the stables at 1:15, huh?"
"Yeah."
"Who's taking her, since I'm on my way to San Diego?"
Lewis uttered a high-pitched, almost female giggle to show that this piece of wit was appreciated.
"Your buddy there, Don Jules."
"He's no buddy of mine."
"No, of course he isn't," Lewis agreed quickly. He thought the orders were a little funny, but since they came right from Cap..."
"Funny? What did he think was funny about them?"
"Well, just to take her out and leave her there. Cap said the stable boys would keep an eye on her, but they don't know from nothing. Don seemed to think it would be taking a hell of a..."
"You know, but he doesn't get paid to think, does he, fatty?" He slapped Lewis on the shoulder, hard. It made a sound like a minor thunderclap.
"No, of course he doesn't."
Lewis came back smartly. He was sweating now.
"See you later," Rainbird said, and went to the door again.
"Leaving?" Lewis was unable to disguise his relief. Rainbird paused with his hand on the doorknob and looked back.
"What do you mean?" he said. "I was never here."
"No, sir, never here," Lewis agreed hastily. Rainbird nodded and slipped out. He closed the door behind him. Lewis stared at the closed door for several seconds, and then uttered a great and gusty sigh of relief. His armpits were humid, and his white shirt was stuck to his back. A few moments later, he picked up his fallen Twinkie, brushed it off, and began to eat it again. The girl was still sitting quietly, not doing anything. How Rainbird, of all people, had got her to like him was a mystery to Lewis Tranter. 7. At 12:45, an eternity after Charlie had awakened, there was a brief buzz at her door, and Don Jules came in, wearing a baseball warm-up jacket and old cord pants. He looked at her coldly and without much interest.
"Come on," he said.
Charlie went with him. 8. That day was cool and beautiful. At 12:30, Rainbird strolled slowly across the still green lawn to the low L-shaped stable with its dark red paint, the color of drying blood, and its brisk white piping. Overhead, great fair-weather clouds marched slowly across the sky. A breeze tugged at his shirt. If dying was required, this was a fine day for it. Inside the stable, he located the head groom's office and went in. He showed his ID with its A-rating stamp.
"Yes, sir?"
Drabble said.
"Clear this place," Rainbird said. "Everyone out. 5 minutes."
The groom did not argue or bumble, and if he paled a bit, his tan covered it.
"The horses, too?"
"Just the people. Out the back." Rainbird had changed into fatigues, what they had sometimes called gook shooters in Nam. The pants' pockets were large, deep, and flapped. From one of these, he now took a large handgun. The head groom looked at it with wise, unsurprised eyes. Rainbird held it loosely, pointed at the floor.
"Is there going to be trouble, sir?"
"There may be," Rainbird said quietly. "I don't really know. Go on now, old man.
I hope no harm will come to the horses,
Drabble said. Rainbird smiled then. He thought, so will she. He had seen her eyes when she was with the horses, and this place, with its bays of loose hay and its lofts of baled hay, with its dry wood all about, was a tinderbox with no smoking signs posted everywhere. It was a thin edge. But as the years had drawn on, and he had become more and more careless of his life, he had walked thinner ones. He walked back to the big double doors and looked out. No sign of anyone just yet. He turned away and began to walk between the stall doors, smelling the sweet, pungent, nostalgic aroma of horse. He made sure all of the stalls were latched and locked. He went back to the double doors again. Now someone was coming, two figures. They were still on the far side of the duck pond, 5 minutes' walk away. Not Cap and Andy McGee. It was Don Jules and Charlie.
Come to me, Charlie, he thought tenderly. Come to me now.
He glanced around at the shadowed upper lofts for a moment and then went to the ladder. Simple wooden rungs nailed to a support beam, and began to climb with lithe ease. 3 minutes later, Charlie and Don Jules stepped into the shadowed, empty coolness of the stable. They stood just inside the doors for a moment as their eyes adjusted to the dimness. The .357 mag in Rainbird's hand had been modified to hold a silencer of Rainbird's own construction. It crouched over the muzzle like a strange black spider. It was not, as a matter of fact, a very silent silencer. It is nearly impossible to completely quiet a big handgun. When, if, he pulled the trigger, it would utter a husky bark the first time, a low report the second time, and then it would be mostly useless. Rainbird hoped not to have to use the gun at all, but now he brought it down with both hands and leveled it so that the silencer covered a small circle on Don Jules's chest. Jules was looking around carefully.
You can go now, Charlie said.
Hey, Jules said, raising his voice and paying no attention to Charlie. Rainbird knew Jules, a bookman. Follow each order to the letter and nobody could put you in hack. Keep your ass covered at all times.
Hey, groom! Somebody! I got the kid here.
You can go now, Charlie said again, and once more Jules ignored her.
Come on, he said, clamping a hand over Charlie's wrist. We got to find somebody.
A bit regretfully, Rainbird prepared to shoot Don Jules. It could be worse. At least Jules would die by the book, and with his ass covered.
I said you could go now, Charlie said, and suddenly Jules let go of her wrist.
He didn't just let go, he pulled his hand away, the way you do when you've grabbed hold of something hot. Rainbird watched this interesting development closely. Jules had turned and was looking at Charlie. He was rubbing his wrist, but Rainbird was able to see if there was a mark there or not.
You get out of here, Charlie said softly.
Jules reached under his coat and Rainbird once more prepared to shoot him. He wouldn't do it until the gun was clear of Jules's jacket and his intention to march her back to the house was obvious. But the gun was only partway out when he dropped it to the barn board floor with a cry. He took two steps backward, away from the girl, his eyes wide. Charlie made a half turn away, as if Jules no longer interested her. There was a faucet protruding from the wall halfway up the long side of the L, and beneath it was a bucket half full of water. Steam began to rise lazily from the bucket. Rainbird didn't think Jules noticed that. His eyes were riveted on Charlie.
Get out of here, you bastard, she said, or I'll burn you up. I'll fry you.
John Rainbird raised Charlie a silent cheer. Jules stood looking at her, indecisive. At this moment, with his head down and slightly cocked, his eyes moving restlessly from side to side, he looked rat-like and dangerous. Rainbird was ready to back her play if she had to make one, but he hoped Jules would be sensible. The power had a way of getting out of control.
Get out right now, Charlie said. Go back where you came from. I'll be watching to see that you do. Move! Get out of here!
The shrill anger in her voice decided him.
Take it easy, he said. Okay. But you got nowhere to go, girl. You got nothing but a hard way to go.
As he spoke, he was easing past her, then backing toward the door.
I'll be watching, Charlie said grimly. Don't you even turn around, you turd.
Jules went out. He said something else, but Rainbird didn't catch it.
Just go,
Charlie cried. She stood in the double doorway, back to Rainbird, in a shower of drowsy afternoon sunlight, a small silhouette. Again, his love for her came over him. This was the place of their appointment, then.
Charlie, he called down softly.
She stiffened and took a single step backward. She didn't turn around, but he could feel the sudden recognition and fury flooding through her, although it was visible only in the slow way that her shoulders came up.
Charlie, he called again. Hey, Charlie.
You, she whispered. He barely caught it. Somewhere below him, a horse nickered softly.
It's me, he agreed. Charlie, it's been me all along.
Now she did turn and swept the long side of the stable with her eyes. Rainbird saw her do this, but she didn't see him. He was behind a stack of bales, well out of sight in the shadowy second loft.
Where are you? She rasped. You tricked me. It was you. My daddy says it was you that time at Granther's.
Her hand had gone unconsciously to her throat, where he had laid in the dart.
Where are you?
Ah, Charlie, wouldn't you like to know? A horse whinnied. No quiet sound of contentment, this, but one of sudden sharp fear. The cry was taken up by another horse. There was a heavy double thud as one of the thoroughbreds kicked at the latched door of his stall.
Where are you?
She screamed again, and Rainbird felt the temperature suddenly begin to rise. Directly below him, one of the horses, Necromancer perhaps, whinnied loudly, and it sounded like a woman screaming. 9. The door buzzer made its curt, rasping cry, and Cap Hollister stepped into Andy's apartment below the North Plantation House. He was not the man he had been a year before. That man had been elderly, but tough and hale and shrewd. That man had possessed a face you might expect to see crouching over the edge of a duck blind in November and holding a shotgun with easy authority. This man walked in a kind of distracted shamble. His hair, a strong iron gray a year ago, was now nearly white and baby fine. His mouth twitched infirmly. But the greatest change was in his eyes, which seemed puzzled and somehow childlike. This expression would occasionally be broken by a shooting sideways glance that was suspicious and fearful and almost cringing. His hands hung loosely by his sides and the fingers twitched aimlessly. The echo had become a ricochet that was now bouncing around his brain with crazy, whistling, deadly velocity. Andy McGee stood to meet him. He was dressed exactly as he had been on that day when he and Charlie had fled up Third Avenue in New York City with the shop sedan trailing behind them. The cord jacket was torn at the seam of the left shoulder now, and the brown twill pants were faded and seat shiny. The weight had been good for him. He felt that he had been able to make his peace with all of this. Not understanding, no. He felt he would never have that, even if he and Charlie somehow managed to beat the fantastic odds and get away and go on living. He could find no fatal flaw in his own character on which to blame this royal balls-up. No sin of the father that needed to be expiated upon his daughter. It wasn't wrong to need $200, or to participate in a controlled experiment, any more than it was wrong to want to be free. If I could get clear, he thought, I'd tell them this. Teach your children, teach your babies, teach them well. They say they know what they are doing, and sometimes they do, but mostly they lie. But it was what it was, n'est-ce pas? One way or another, they would at least have a run for their money. But that brought him no feeling of forgiveness or understanding for the people who had done this. In finding peace with himself, he had banked the fires of his hate for the faceless bureau cretins who had done this in the name of national security or whatever it was. Only they weren't faceless now. One of them stood before him, smiling and twitching and vacant. Andy felt no sympathy for Cap's state at all.
You brought it on yourself, chum.
Hello, Andy,
Cap said.
All ready?
Yes, Andy said. Carry one of my bags, would you? Cap's vacuity was broken by one of those falsely shrewd glances.
Have you checked them?
He barked.
Checked them for snakes?
Andy pushed, not hard. He wanted to save as much as he could for an emergency. Pick it up, he said, gesturing at one of the two suitcases. Cap walked over and picked it up. Andy grabbed the other one.
Where's your car?
It's right outside, Cap said.
It's been brought around.
Will anyone check on us? What he meant was, will anyone try to stop us?
Why would they?
Cap asked, honestly surprised.
I'm in charge.
Andy had to be satisfied with that. We're going out, he said, and we're going to put these bags in the trunk.
Trunk's okay,
Cap broke in.
I checked it this morning.
And then we're going to drive around to the stable and get my daughter. Any questions?
No,
Cap said.
Fine, let's go.
They left the apartment and walked to the elevator. A few people moved up and down the hall on their own errands. They glanced cautiously at Cap and then looked away. The elevator took them up to the ballroom, and Cap led the way down a long front hall. Josie, the redhead who had been on the door the day Cap had ordered Al Steinowitz to Hastings Glen, had gone on to bigger and better things. Now, a young, prematurely balding man sat there, frowning over a computer programming text. He had a yellow felt-tip pen in one hand. He glanced up as they approached.
Hello, Richard, Cap said. Hitting the books?
Richard laughed.
They're hitting me, is more like it.
He glanced at Andy curiously. Andy looked back noncommittally. Cap slipped his thumb into a slot, and something thumped. A green light shone on Richard's console.
Destination?
Richard asked. He exchanged his felt tip for a ballpoint. It hovered over a small bound book.
Stable, Cap said briskly. We're going to pick up Andy's daughter, and they are going to escape.
Andrews Air Force Base, Andy countered and pushed. Pain settled immediately into his head like a dull meat cleaver.
Andrews AFB,
Richard agreed, and jotted it into the book, along with the time.
Have a good day, gentlemen.
They went out into breezy October sunshine. Cap's Vega was drawn up on the clean white crushed stone of the circular driveway. Give me your keys, Andy said. Cap handed them over. Andy opened the trunk, and they stowed the luggage. Andy slammed the trunk and handed the keys back.
Let's go.
Cap drove them on a loop around the duck pond to the stables. As they went, Andy noticed a man in a baseball warm-up jacket running across to the house they had just left. Andy felt a tickle of unease. Cap parked in front of the open stable doors. He reached for the keys, and Andy slapped his hand lightly.
No, leave it running.
Come on. He got out of the car. His head was thudding, sending rhythmic pulses of pain deep into his brain, but it wasn't too bad yet. Not yet. Cap got out, then stood, irresolute.
I don't want to go in there, he said.
His eyes shifted back and forth wildly on their sockets.
Too much dark. They like the dark. They hide. They bite.
There are no snakes, Andy said, and pushed out lightly. It was enough to get Cap moving, but he didn't look very convinced. They walked into the stable. For one wild, terrible moment, Andy thought she wasn't there. The change from light to shadow left his eyes momentarily helpless. It was hot and stuffy in here, and something had upset the horses. They were whinnying and kicking at their stalls. Andy could see nothing.
Charlie?
He called, his voice cracked and urgent.
Charlie?
Daddy! She called, and gladness shot through him. Gladness that turned to dread when he heard the shrill fear in her voice.
Daddy, don't come in! Don't come!
I think it's a little late for that, a voice said from somewhere overhead. 10. Charlie, the voice had called down softly. It was somewhere overhead, but where? It seemed to come from everywhere. The anger had gusted through her, anger that was fanned by the hideous unfairness of it, the way that it never ended, the way they had of being there at every turn, blocking every lunge for escape. Almost at once she felt it start to come up from inside her. It was always so much closer to the surface now, so much more eager to come bursting out. Like with the man who had brought her over. When he drew his gun, she had simply made it hot so he would drop it.
He was lucky the bullets hadn't exploded right inside it. Already she could feel the heat gathering inside her and beginning to radiate out as the weird battery, or whatever it was, turned on. She scanned the dark lofts overhead but couldn't spot him. There were too many stacks of bales, too many shadows. "I wouldn't, Charlie." His voice was a little louder now, but still calm. It cut through the fog of rage and confusion. "You ought to come down here," Charlie cried loudly. She was trembling. "You ought to come down before I decide to set everything on fire. I can do it." "I know you can," the soft voice responded. It floated down from nowhere, everywhere. "But if you do, you're going to burn up a lot of horses, Charlie. Can't you hear them?" She could. Once he had called it to her attention, she could. They were nearly mad with fear, whinnying and battering at their latched doors. Necromancer was in one of those stalls. Her breath caught in her throat. Again she saw the trench of fire running across the Mander's yard and the chickens exploding. She turned toward the bucket of water again and was now badly frightened. The power was trembling on the edge of her ability to control it. And in another moment, back off. It was going to blow loose. Back off. And just go sky high. Back off, back off, do you hear me? Back off! This time the half-full bucket did not just steam. It came to an instant furious boil. A moment later the chrome faucet just over the bucket twisted twice, spun like a propeller, and then blew off the pipe jutting from the wall. The fixture flew the length of the stable like a rocket payload and caromed off the far wall. Water gushed from the pipe. Cold water. She could feel its coldness. But moments after the water spurted out, it turned to steam, and a hazy mist filled the corridor between the stalls. A coiled green hose that hung on a peg next to the pipe had fused its plastic loops. Back off! She began to get control of it again and pull it down. A year ago, she would have been incapable of that. The thing would have had to run its own destructive course. She was able to hold on better now. Ah, but there was so much more to control. She stood there, shivering. "What more do you want?" she asked in a low voice. "Why can't you just let us go?" A horse whinnied, high and frightened. Charlie understood exactly how it felt. "No one thinks you can just be let go," Rainbird's quiet voice answered. "I don't even think your father thinks so. You're dangerous, Charlie, and you know it. We could let you go, and the next men that grabbed you might be Russians or North Koreans. Maybe even the heathen Chinee. You may think I'm kidding, but I'm not."
"That's not my fault," she cried.
"No," Rainbird said meditatively. "Of course it isn't. But it's all bullshit anyway. I don't care about the Z factor, Charlie. I never did. I only care about you."
"Oh, you liar," Charlie screamed shrilly. "You tricked me, pretended to be something you weren't."
She stopped. Rainbird climbed easily over a low pile of bales, then sat down on the edge of the loft with his feet dangling down. The pistol was in his lap. His face was like a ruined moon above her.
"Lied to you?"
"No. I mixed up the truth, Charlie. That's all I ever did. And I did it to keep you alive."
"Dirty liar,"
she whispered, but was dismayed to find that she wanted to believe him. The sting of tears began behind her eyes. She was so tired, and she wanted to believe him. Wanted to believe he had liked her.
"You weren't testing," Rainbird said. "Your old man wasn't testing either.
What were they going to do?
Say, 'Oh, sorry, we made a mistake,' and put you back on the street?"
"You've seen these guys at work, Charlie. You saw them shoot that guy Manders in Hastings Glen. They pulled out your own mother's fingernails and then kissed—"
"Stop it!"
she screamed in agony, and the power stirred again, restlessly close to the surface.
"No, I won't," he said. "Time you had the truth, Charlie. I got you going. I made you important to them. You think I did it because it's my job? The fuck I did. They're assholes. Cap Hockstetter, Pinchot, that guy Jules who brought you over here.